Blog Talk Radio.
It's Super Bowl Sunday. We're live from Duluth, Minnesota. Did you catch those last two plays? Number 21 on the Patriots won it for the team. He took it for the home team, and he was a Christian, and he pointed his finger upward. The minute that he completed that play, once he got to the sidelines, that is. We had a contest at work, and I guessed 27-24 with the Patriots in favor. And so it was actually rather exciting. Now, I'm kind of surprised that Wikipedia has already updated the final results. The Patriots were strong in the first half, and then Seattle caught up, and they were tied 14-14. And then in the third period, Seattle gained an edge. They gained 10 points. And in the fourth period, New England scored one touchdown and then one right at the end. Because there was one person, Seattle had completed a huge play, and then the guy was like 3 yards from the end zone, and Mr. Wilson on the other side, the quarterback, threw the ball, and number 21 on the Patriots caught it, and he was able to stave them off. Now, I'm going to text good old John and see why he hasn't called in yet, because I am not a professional player or observer of this type of sport anymore. One moment, please. I do believe, though, that the game was really quite exciting, and I was at work all night with other people. For the second season in a row, but only the third time in 21 seasons, the number one seed from each conference met in the league championship game. This was the first time in a decade that an NFL team played in a consecutive Super Bowl games, with the last such instance in 2004 and 2005, when the Patriots played in Super Bowls 38 and 39 respectively. Super Bowl 49 was the Seahawks' second consecutive Super Bowl appearance, having defeated the Denver Broncos 43-8 in Super Bowl 48 in 2014. While New England returned for their eighth Super Bowl appearance and their first since losing 21-17 to the New York Giants in 2012. Okay, we have Bob on the line. Good evening, Bob.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm
good
fine,
evening.
Thank you.
Yeah,
good evening.
I was going to start the show off with just a quick interlude of Super Bowl 49. Did you guys only watch the halftime show, or did you watch the last 5 minutes of the game?
No, we watched the halftime show primarily, but we did catch at the very end of the game, like the last quarter.
Yeah, John's on the line, too. John, did you catch the last fourth quarter of the Super Bowl series?
You know, I actually heard about it. And, in fact, as Slick is watching the replay of the game, as he is yelling at the TV right now.
he
likes to tape it and listen to it.
There was a wide receiver from the Seattle Seahawks who caught a ball and landed on about yard 3. So it was pretty much a shoo-in that they were probably going to win. And then Wilson, the quarterback on the Seattle team, threw the ball in the end zone. There were two Seattle Seahawks flanking number 21 for the Patriots. He caught the ball. It was a turnover, and the Patriots won.
Wow.
No, there's only one reason I'm that excited. We had a contest at work before the game to guess what the score would be, and I guessed 27-24 Patriots. And I was only off by 1 point, and I won the contest.
Look at you. Well, now, just a trivia question, because I haven't seen the play. Did he throw it in the middle of the field or towards the corners, like going out of bounds?
It was the middle.
I have this thing, that, and it's, I call it Brett Favre syndrome. For some reason, and I've talked to this, it's like Kurt Warner used to do this too, and he's done it in the Super Bowl twice. If you're at the 2 or 3 yard line, the one thing you don't want to do is throw it over the middle and have it intercepted. All you do is throw it to the corners, and someone can at least, you know, where your guy can get it alone, and it's very rarely picked off. I see this over and over again. Quarterbacks try to force it in the middle. They get excited, and they get intercepted. They wonder why, you know, it's like trying to jump into an elevator full of people.
Well, it was really a fluke, John, because that last guy who caught the ball, he did it with 2 minutes and 52 seconds to go, the Seattle Seahawks guy. So they were in prime position to score and win.
Right. So you kind of go, the last thing you want to do is throw an interception on the 3 yard line. Now, here's the question. Did Katy Perry lose any clothes at halftime, or did she keep it together?
No, in fact, her third... You can talk, Bob.
It was a very, very good performance.
Really?
Especially the end. Yeah. It was not a Miley Cyrus.
Right.
Come in like a wrecking ball. It was not that kind of performance at all. And mainly, if you know the early Katy Perry,
mm-hmm.
it was in that style. But the fireworks were just tremendous, and her going up in the air like that and everything, just with all of the it was a tremendous performance.
Was it kind of on the PG Disney kind of show spectacle?
Yeah,
her
third
well,
song
except
they,
that
they had
one,
baby
one the,
beach balls. Go ahead, Bob.
Except that one of the songs she sang was I Kissed a Girl. That was her controversial song, and that was
right.
amongst her songs. That was in there. But all the rest of it was PG-13.
No. Interesting. Well, you know, it's one of those things. So I talked to someone earlier today, and I said, you know, it's kind of a two-edged sword, because I said Katy Perry was a God girl. Her parents are ministers, and they still are. They're radical. And she grew up in fact, she wasn't allowed to say deviled eggs. They had to be angeled eggs and things like that. They're so strict. And she actually was radical. I heard one of her first songs as a Christian release. It was fantastic. It was like one of those, this is what I would do, you know, if I was a girl. And I was, as a guy, I was doing the same stuff, you know, except it was in a rock format. And she got signed. They released her song, her CD or tape, and it sold 300 copies, and they dropped her. And so she did what most any other kid in that, you know, growing up in a church that faces rejection. She went out in the world, and she made something for herself. And so the problem is, I'm criticizing her because she compromised, but if she never compromised, I never would have heard about her, and I never would be able to criticize. Like, it justifies her point. She was going nowhere as a Christian artist. She became somebody in the secular world. And now I'm criticizing her for being successful. I guess the difference would be, if I made it successfully in the secular world, I would take my extra money and funnel it into churches and doing my own ministry, whereas these people have all the money, they don't ever have to work again, and they keep going, trying to get higher and higher in this secular world, this trap.
You mean something like the bank robber that gives half the money he steals to the church?
Yes. And you know, what's interesting is, like, just to, you know, in the last 3 days, if you look at the celebrity world, because it kind of bumps heads and shoulders with reality, you've got Whitney Houston's daughter emulating her, right? Ends up, you know, unconscious in a bathtub like her mom.
Yes.
You have Suge Knight, you know, it's like he wants to join OJ in prison. He should be happy living his life free outside of prison. So what does he do? Let's run over a guy so I can go back and be in prison the rest of my life. We have Bruce Jenner, you know, who's like the epitome, when I was growing up, of a man. Attractive, strong, right. Virile, you know, decathlon athlete, American hero. And he gets hooked up with this drama called the Kardashians, and totally disgendered by his, you know, wife, you know, and basically cut off his man parts psychologically. And here he is, you know, doing the whole transgender thing, and apparently it's not just rumor, it's what's being confirmed. And you go, what? This is just in the entertainment world. What is going on? Crazy.
Okay, well, John, I was just going to tell you that her third song, she had these cartoon dolphins with palm trees with eyes and a smile and beach balls with eyes, and that was more like the PBS, you know, toddler hour instead of Disney. But then I saw in a teaser video, she had like these cupcake boobs with cherries and two of her dancers. And I didn't see that one. I only saw Missy Elliott sing two songs. And I saw Katie sing, she came in on a tiger and sang her Roar song.
Right.
And then she sang another song, and then she had that Disney type one, and then I didn't see I saw Missy Elliott do two performances, and Lenny Kravitz played the guitar on one with Katy Perry.
Well, you know, the problem with almost all the artists in her genre is that they start out as pop stars, and they appeal to a young audience. So they target that kind of 8 to 14-year-old crowd, the kind of the Disney crowd, get hot, whether it's Britney, Christina Aguilera, Jessica Simpson, Mandy Moore, Hilary Duff, and you could just, you know, you go on and on, the gal that's with Bieber's, you know, ex-girlfriend, Selena Gomez, I think. The point is, they hit with this crowd, and they go this pure kind of Disney, wholesome entertainment thing, and then their crowd grows up. These kids turn, you know, 17, 18, 20. They start smoking, drinking, and going to clubs and bar hopping. And to keep up with their audience, that's their core audience, they basically lead the way of corruption. You know, they're showing more skin. They got to have a selfie, you know, with their underwear off or something goofy, you know, nipple showing. And it's just this common path. I mean, it's not like some strange formula. It's just like they're leading their group as they grow old. Kind of like the Beatles, you know, they were kind of wholesome, and you see them do the whole drugs and long hair and experimentation thing, and it's
well,
just,
you know, everybody has to take their tour through the world, and eventually they come out on the other side, and they either recover and get back into who they used to be, or they just become an icon legend like Keith Richards.
Right, right. I know,
but
for one thing, the ones who don't, who like, I don't think
we
she
do
does
have
drugs.
Another topic, though. The topic is the Saudi-Israeli relations over the. So you can do the wrap-up quick, and then we're going to go into something else.
Yeah, well, transition, I was going to say, is that as long as she stays, I think, out of the chemical stuff, you know, the alcohol, the drug, or pills kind of thing, I think, yeah, they do tend to resolve themselves back to, you know, square one. I think the artists that don't, they just continue on this path, whether it's Michael or Whitney or Elvis or Jim Morrison or Jimi Hendrix. And you can just go down the list of, you know, who's who. Once you go chemical, it's just a very self-destructive path. And but it's just this kind of madness that's in the world. It's in the entertainment celebrity world. And I guess the reason Bruce Jenner's doing all this stuff is because he's out doing, you know, he's getting headlines. It's the MO. It's the modus operandi. And, you know, it goes over into the terrorist world, you know, groups beheading people and doing bizarre, crazy stuff, you know, to get the publicity. And it's like, it's something we talked about last week, Jane. It's like, let everyone do what they're going to do for 24 hours. And after that, knock it off. You know, if you're going to start shooting people and blowing things up, I don't care who you are, we're going to nuke you, you know. Just get you off the planet. But, you know, get it out of your system, and then let's just start living peacefully. I don't
cool.
think it's a popular format, but that's my campaign slogan. Get it out of your system.
Yeah, well, she's still a young kid, you know, like, give her time. Now, and she's not that sleazy compared, like, to some of the acts that Bob mentioned,
no.
Miley
oh,
Cyrus.
No.
So, anyways, well, I'm having a hard time, and I haven't been able to tap Bob because he has company back in town, but I was reading this book on Ariel Sharon. His nickname's Eric. He was the military leader and then the prime minister of Israel. But I've been trying to write a distinctive article about the Saudis. And, you know, the Saudis have ridden the fence between the Arab world and the Western influences for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
They, the Bush family's been close to the Saudis, and even when Bush Jr. was in office, they bullied him and did not... into trying to show some support for a Palestinian state in George Bush's second term, I believe, Jr., Bush 43. And Bob and I were briefly discussing the history, which I've already am familiar with, but there are no diplomatic relations between the Saudis and Israel. However, they're both against Iran developing a nuclear program. And they're also United States allies. But for some reason, they can't meet in the center. And, you know, neither of them fully trust each other. But there's been a couple secret deals with military transition to try to wipe out Gaddafi in the region and also suppress Libya. So, Bob, what do you know about the Saudi royal family that's distinctive to you?
Well, a little over 100 years ago, the Arabian Peninsula was divided into like a dozen or more small kingdoms, you know. And one, the Ibn Saud, his city was Riyadh, which was a really just a medium-sized town. It wasn't a city like it is today. It was a almost a small town. And he managed to conquer a couple of other small, Ha'il and I forget the other one, towns, small royal states.
Yeah, he went out in the desert with his brothers, and they recaptured those two holy cities, Mecca and Medina.
Much later. I mean, I'm going back to the beginning. Initially, he was a small king of all the 12 or 15 kingdoms that the Arabian Peninsula was divided into. He was one of the smaller ones. And then in the 1920s, what happened was an American geologist was hired by an American company to locate the gold, King Solomon's gold mines, you know, and
right, and they bought land
too.
And they struck some other kind of gold, which I'll let you tell.
Black gold.
And what happened was, he did, you know, find a few locations that might have gold, which is what he was hired to do. He spent a good year, maybe more, in the Arabian Peninsula looking all over the place. But he also, when he got the eastern part of sort of Saudi Arabia, you know, so Al Hasa province, which by that time was had been conquered by Ibn Saud, he realized these are the geological formations that you find oil in, and he realized there's a tremendous amount of oil in eastern Saudi Arabia, so he kept his mouth shut. Came back to America. He gave the report about where gold might be to the company that hired him, but he didn't say anything about the oil. He wasn't hired to go look for it, you know. And he approached several American oil companies. So I know somewhere in the world there's a tremendous amount of oil. I'll let you know. Say I'm making this up, like $1 million. I'll tell you the location. And they all said no to him except for one. Standard Oil, which was a major oil company in this country anyway. Standard Oil said, "Yeah, we'll give you $1 million if it turns out that there really is a lot of oil in this area." And so Standard Oil went and signed a contract with King Ibn Saud. It was a 99-year contract. This is somewhere around 1925.
It was 1933.
I didn't think it was that late, but maybe. Yeah, okay.
Actually, it was 1933 when the foreign oil prospectors came, so you're right, it was probably around 1925.
But King Ibn Saud did not want money. He wanted 500 horses. And that's what Standard Oil paid him.
Where
Yes, where his cavalry.
He was just horsing around.
And with these horses, he was able to conquer a few more small kingdoms in the Arabian Peninsula. And one of them was, as Jane mentioned before, you know, on the western side of the Arabian Peninsula, Mecca, Medina. You know, he went out and was able to add them to his a kingdom in the south between Mecca and Medina and Yemen. There was a kingdom called Asir, and he managed to conquer it. And for the next couple of years, that's all he wanted was horses for his cavalry.
That's cool.
And meanwhile, he was slowly eating up the Arabian Peninsula, becoming by this time the largest kingdom in the Arabian Peninsula. Now, others survived. Yemen still survived as an independent. Muscat and Oman survived as an independent kingdom. And along the area that we call the Trucial States, had treaties with England. So the British Navy, the reason they were called the Trucial States is because of the truce that they had signed with Great Britain. You know, and a couple of little places survived on the eastern coast, you know, again, because they had the protection of the British. That's why places like Qatar, you know, Bahrain, Kuwait, this is why they weren't gobbled up by Ibn Saud. In the early years, like in the 1930s, and even into the 40s, the Saudis really weren't ostentatious with their wealth. It was only after World War II that they began building fancy palaces and buying, making trips to Paris and London on shopping sprees. Getting back to the first king, Ibn Saud again. He was a strict Muslim of the Wahhabi branch.
Wahhabism,
yes. When these American engineers came to Saudi Arabia around 1930, you know, by that beginning, somewhere around 1923 in America and West Europe, radio was all the rage. You know, and radio was pretty well established by this time. But King Ibn Saud said, no, this thing is not mentioned in the Quran. It will be illegal in my kingdom. No radio in Saudi Arabia. But it seems that amongst the British, across the, in England and, you know, the British colonies and Middle East and so forth, there's a kind of person that's called an Arabist. This is usually an Englishman who's in love with the Arab Muslim culture, the camels going across the desert and the tents and the oases. And he's in love with this kind of stuff. There's been quite a few people like that. One of them's name was St. John Filby, and he was an aristocrat back in England, but he loved the Arab, the Bedouin lifestyle. And he was a friend of King Ibn Saud. He lived at least half his life. He lived, you know, with King Ibn Saud.
In a documentary, they mentioned that he liked that. That he liked going out in the desert with his Bedouin friends.
Yeah. And he convinced King Ibn Saud that when you're like traveling out in the desert, you know, with the radio, you'll be able to hear on Friday, the Muslim holy day. You could hear the readings, you know, with the Quran, you know, on the air. You don't have to be in a city where there's a mosque. And that was the argument that won over. And King Ibn Saud said, yes, because the Quran can be broadcast over the radio, I will allow it in my kingdom. And by the way, St. John Philby, his son was Kim Philby, the British spy in the Philby affair.
Wow.
You know, that was his son. But anyway.
Bob has inside information, John, that I don't even know about.
Well, the truth is, I read a book called The Modern Middle East by Sidney Nettleton Fisher when I was a teenager. So we're talking, you know, we're talking almost 50 years ago. By Modern Middle East, his cutoff is somewhere around 1960 is where the book cuts off at. But I love that book.
What was the name of the book? I'm
sorry. It's called The Modern Middle East. There are many books called The Modern Middle East. This one was written by Sidney Nettleton Fisher.
Excellent.
The English spelling, F-I-S-H-E-R.
I studied the history from 1902 to present day. One of the one who ruled from 1932 to 53, he actually had syphilis at one time. And the one, Faisal, who was the best educated, he was killed by his nephew for vengeance because his nephew got killed in a protest. They were protesting against television coming to Saudi Arabia. And a couple of years later, he avenged his uncle, who was the king, and killed him.
And radio. Where is he?
Yeah, I saw a documentary. King Faisal was the hardest working king of all the ones in the last 100 years. He worked 12 to 13-hour days.
Wow.
Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, that part of the world is very medieval and backward and fundamentalist. Not in Saudi Arabia, but in Muscat and Oman. In the 1960s, they still had auction block slavery. Foreign pilots would go kidnap and transport blacks from East Africa up to Muscat and Oman. You know, for auction block slavery, so
Amman
the UN
Jordan?
Was holding. Excuse me. No,
you
no,
said
Muscat
Amman.
And
I said Amman Jordan. No.
O-M-A-N.
Okay. Did you know that, Bob? For the trivia question, which United States president asked Saudi Arabia to end slavery? In the 20th century.
I have
President
no idea.
Kennedy. President Kennedy.
Okay.
He asked them to end slavery. He told them it was inhumane and that they should quit. And King, the person who was ruling at that time, ended slavery.
Okay.
It was right. It was right before King Saud got despoted.
And anyway,
Muscat
and Oman had auction block slavery at least until the 1960s. The UN was investigating them for it. And part of all this was that Muscat and Oman had, television was illegal in the country, not so much because they didn't want people to see television, but they didn't want TV filming things inside their country. They didn't want things to be filmed and shown to the rest of the world. So they made television, you know, illegal in Muscat and Oman.
During the rule from 1932 to present day, there's been several times where it was illegal to protest. So therefore, like John mentioned, killing people over television, it makes more sense what you said, Bob, that they were worried about what was going to be filmed.
Yeah, I mean, there's part of the problem is that the Saudi monarchy understands that if a country is has Western education and Western freedoms, the people will want a greater share of the wealth. The Saudis do not share the wealth with the people. There's a huge gap between the wealth of the upper classes in Saudi Arabia and the poverty of most of the country. Of the 9/11 hijackers, okay, of the 19 of them.
They were rich like Bin Laden.
No, they were not. They came from southwestern
really?
Saudi Arabia. Yes, they came from the poorest part of Saudi Arabia. The poorest part, the southwestern part.
Okay, well,
part.
Bin Laden,
Right. Bin Laden, he was rich. Absolutely, his family was very rich. He was, yes, absolutely. He was, and the Bin Laden family was. But the hijackers themselves were recruited from the poorest part of Saudi Arabia, the southwestern corner, right next to Yemen. 17 of the 19 came from that area.
Wow. Thanks for the tip.
You're welcome.
Well, you know, I'm going to let you and John talk a minute. I have to step in the other room, and we have 13 minutes left, but we've kind of been shutting John out. So, John,
I'm digging it. This is great.
Well, Bob filled in a lot of the blanks for me, and now my article is going to be that much better. I like the story about the 500 horses and the trestle states. So the thing is that, you know, on some levels, I feel like I just want to say one thing before I leave the room. I'll be back in a minute. The Saudi leadership has been very level-headed at times. I mean, they've weighed matters. They don't make snap decisions. They don't make unhealthy alliances. They balance out the Western powers, but I think one reason is because they did have that Aramco, that United States Saudi oil company, and they made things in the best interest
Aramco.
Of their country. Yeah, Aramco.
It's Aramco.
Sorry. They made things in the best interest, national interest, self-preservation, which is technically what a good country is supposed to do, but they also... There was a time where FDR explained to the king in 1945, King Abd al-Aziz, I can't say the name like Bob says it, but King Aziz, I'll just abbreviate. He told him that the Jewish were really punished by the Germans and that they do need their own homeland. Now, there was a debate with the Saudis and others that could some of the Palestinians live in Israel once it was established? I don't know. They were afraid that the Palestinians were going to get shut out like many of them have. Go ahead, you guys.
Okay.
I'll let you
John.
Take the floor now.
Well, what I like is that Bob has such concise knowledge regarding Middle East and some of the histories there, and it's phenomenal. It's like being in a history class and, you know, just hitting the button and boom, up comes the screen and all the information. So I think it's awesome. I love absorbing it.
Thank you. The Saudis have traditionally been close to the United States because of the oil relationship. Sometime, I'm going to say around 1980, there was a minor member of the Saudi royal family who went to Oxford and studied economics. I cannot remember the guy's, since I was talking with Jane this morning, I've been trying to remember the guy's name. But he, as a member of the Saudi royal family, he had access to the king. Now, in this country, there are many, many salespeople representing the big American defense companies, defense manufacturers, who would love to have about 5 minutes with the King of Arabia, and just can't get it. But this guy had access to the king, and he was educated in Oxford and in, you know, economics and finance and so forth. And he made a big pitch, you know, to the king about buying all kinds of advanced American weapons. And he sold literally billions of dollars worth of American weapons were sold, you know, to the Saudis during the 1980s, with this guy as the he's getting 10% or something of all he got. He made a tremendous amount of money. Kadashi, something like that. His name was something like Kadashi. I can't remember. But he's part of the equation too of, you know, the modern Saudi Arabia, because he transformed Saudi from a country with no modern weapons. Now the Saudis built large underground complexes with missiles and all kinds of things that they didn't have, you know, up until the 1970s. They didn't have anything like this. And then having once done that, the Saudis went a step further. They stepped beyond the United States, and they were obtaining missile systems from the Chinese without telling us. We learned about it with American satellites, you know, photographing Saudi Arabia. So what? That's a Chinese missile complex there they're constructing. You can tell by the patterns of how they construct things. You know,
that's pretty intense.
They're playing their own game.
I have a question, Bob. Do you just call that king that ruled from 1932 to 53 Ibn Saud?
That's the last. I was talking about the first king, Ibn Saud. It's not Saud, it's Saud.
Okay.
You notice sometimes it's spelled S-A apostrophe U-D.
Okay, I was just checking.
And in the Middle East, Arabs, they usually don't call it Saudi Arabia. They just call it Saudi or... Saudia is the short form of the name of the country amongst Arabs in all over the Middle East.
I do like the fact that I read something interesting today that even though it's a royal family and it's the man produced so many children, but it had a name to it that the lineage went in the form of brothers, not generations. And there was a word for it that I can look up before the show.
So it's kind of like a succession of...
Of brothers, but it's not like England where it's generation to generation. Like there's one person per generation that runs.
Right, so it's kind of like a form of nepotism in a way.
I don't know the word for that.
Yeah, I know it. I can look it up because I copied and pasted it. But basically, we have 6 minutes left. Does anyone want to be... We each have 2 minutes to wrap the show up. Who wants to go first?
Well, first of all, if Wheaties knew that Bruce Jenner was going to do a transgender change, I just don't think he would have made the cover of their box 30 years ago. Could you, you know, talking about how times have changed? I mean, you know, it's comical, but when you think about it, like 30 years from now, transgender Bruce, they would have just fallen over with a heart attack, I think. I could be wrong. How the times have changed.
I was very upset. You know, that was like a rumor that was swirling around for 2 months, and I didn't believe it. And now it's legitimate. He is changing body types.
Well, he's got to be one up on, you know, on the circle of people, and it really kind of goes to Kris Jenner.
He was around those big-boobed women too long. He wanted a piece of it.
Well, it's like with her, she was, like, if you just see an interview with her talking, she seems like a cool, nice lady, but it just seems like everything around her she touches, it makes money by turning them into little circus freak shows. It's with her daughters and, you know, just all the kids and everyone around them. It's just a circle of insanity, and she knows how to promote it and make money off of it and exploit it. But I think in the end, it's very self-destructive to our culture, too. And it's just kind of sad.
Yes. Well, we've gone from Tom Brady to a rookie from West Virginia winning the Super Bowl to people trading horses for oil. And now we're in a post-Olympian hero turning into a woman. By the way, I wanted to tell you guys something. Unlike many European royal families, the Saudi successions are not based on... The word of the day is primogeniture. Instead of passing from the king to the eldest son, which is called primogeniture, it passes to a brother.
Wow.
So, Bob, I've said all I have to say tonight. What's your conclusion for the night? And by the way, hello to Kim and her dad.
Oh, I just I enjoyed the Katy Perry halftime show. Yeah, I wish she would keep going in that direction, you know, and less of the "I kissed a girl" type stuff, and more of the early. Katy Perry type of concerts. So
I think she's all American wholesome. I just want to make one remark, and then I'll let you finish. Madonna is such a perfectionist. I felt like her Super Bowl performance, from each act to the next, was very unified. And her, of course, her dance moves were perfect, even though people might not like her content so much. She was pretty clean and polished 2 years ago when she performed. John and Bob, you can both finish it out. I'll just listen. We have 4 minutes left.
Well, I know with Madonna, when she performed, I'm not a Madonna fan, although I do respect what she's done. I like some of her earlier work. What I really liked is, she has a couple songs, but one of them I thought was fantastic. It was Like a Prayer. I thought, Like a Prayer, and she performed that at the Super Bowl. She closed with it, and it was one of those great, you know, it's like a real spiritual connection thing. We are living in a world, though, where basically people talk about, you know, they love God, and meanwhile they're stripping for their selfies and things like that. So we've got a culture that's kind of confused. It's kind of mixed up with a whole bunch of different things. But I do believe that... the truth is out there for people who want it. And at the end of the day, the culture will, out of a void, will seek God. The only question will be, will we be on our knees willingly in prayer, or will we be on our knees due to terrorists in life, you know, slamming us, and that's why we're asking for God's help. And I pray that it will be not out of necessity, but out of free will. And, you know, that's my prayer for America. And
is our goal in life to just self-glorify and become the best singer or artist? Like, it seems like a big contest in America for Taylor Swift and Katy Perry to outdo each other. And by
right.
the way, Missy Elliott performed two songs too, and she's kind of racy, but she is talented.
It's the culture, and you know, it's because of, you know, all the Twittering and, you know, Instagram stuff. It just, the news gets a hold of it, and they're looking for a fight. You know, they're looking for a cat fight. You know, Katy said this about Taylor Swift. And
well, she
I'm
said
sure,
it the day before the Super Bowl, so she kind of brought, Katy Perry did. She brought bad publicity on herself.
And I'm sure, you know, we call it bad, but it's like, it's calculated. You know, we want people to tune in. She needs the ratings. You know, even I think about a week ago, I heard something like her and John Mayer, you know, hanging out or whatever. You know, maybe he even needs a little boost for